The headlines, the projection suggests that Republicans will take control of a U.S. House of Representatives as vote counting continues in U.S. midterm elections. A convoy of tankers comes under attack on the Iraqi-Syria border. Reports say that it was delivering Iranian fuel to Lebanon. And South Korea says its neighboring North has fired a ballistic missile off its east coast as tensions mount on the Korean Peninsula.
Hello and welcome to your world news, coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
We're beginning this bulletin with the latest on the U.S. midterm elections. The future of Congress hangs in the balance, as it is still unclear whether Democrats will be able to keep their majority in both the Senate and the House. No party is currently holding a lead in the Senate. There are 100 seats up for grabs, and people are waiting on the fate of only four of them. In the U.S. House, Republicans have been able to secure more seats than Democrats, despite many votes having yet to come in. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy says that it is clear that Republicans will take control of the House. So there are 435 seats up for grabs in that chamber. A shift in power in Congress would make Democratic President Joe Biden a lame duck for his remaining 2 years in office.
A lot of people are anxious about the outcome of this election. You had a president who came in thinking that he had a mandate to build America better, fix infrastructure, deal with some of the racial inequities here, deal with some of the issues dealing with some of the more marginalized communities across the country. You also had to deal with the abortion issue, which became an issue during his presidency when the Supreme Court overturned the Roe versus Wade ruling, something that was established in the early 70s. So now you have people on the president's political side, Democrats, saying we have to show up at the polls. At the same time, though, historically, whatever party is in power usually suffers some type of losses during the midterm elections. This was supposed to be augmented, especially during Biden's time in office, because he's not a very popular president. He has a low approval rating. Congress has a low approval rating. So there was expected to be a lot of Republicans just wiping out Democrats. And therefore, it would be a huge loss for Biden and his political allies. What we're looking at, however, is a divided Congress, if everything that is occurring now holds true when the final votes come in. This will make it extremely difficult for the president to pass any cogent policy alluding to anything that he had promised on the campaign trail.
Reports are coming out of the Iraqi-Syria border saying two tankers carrying fuel have come under attack. At least four explosions reportedly rocked the Qa'im border crossing early on Wednesday. Iraqi media have quoted intelligence sources as saying that the tankers were carrying Iranian fuel to Lebanon, adding that the explosions left no casualties. Some local sources say the attack was a drone strike. An Iraqi source speaking on condition of anonymity said that the attack had been carried out by the Israeli regime. Faraz al-Najim, a human rights activist, is joining us right now. Mr. Najim, if you could please tell us more about the different aspects of this attack and the fact that they are now accusing Iran that the fuel was Iranian fuel being sent to Lebanon. What is the information that you have regarding this incident?
Yes. What we hear now, you know, on the news is that the fuel tankers were bombed. The U.S. is not taking charge of this. Nobody has declared who did this exactly. You know, some sources are saying that the Israelis could be behind this. I mean, the U.S. and the Zionists have a history of doing such attacks, violating airspace, violating international law. You know, nothing major has happened since the time of the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the great generals in Iraq. But the new prime minister in Iraq, you know, this is an opportunity for Mr. Sudani to take real action and investigate this crime and see who is behind this. They're obviously trying to also sabotage any relations between Iran and Iraq at this moment, because there's a new prime minister and there's, a little bit of issues happening inside of Iran. And obviously, we know that the U.S. is behind a lot of this stuff and the Israelis. And if they get down to finding out that the Israelis were behind this, then there should be a major retaliation by the Iraqi government and by the Iraqi army against the Israelis. It should be obviously also taken to the United Nations, a formal complaint, so this doesn't happen ever again. At the same time, the Popular Mobilization Forces, also has a role, hopefully, in retaliating on behalf of the Iraqi people and the nation if the Iraqi army doesn't do its job, because that's, any country that is attacked by another country has a right to retaliate and defend its territories. The Lebanese people are under a serious embargo, and any assistance to them or any fuel or any gas, anything sent to them, especially while it's coordinated and it's something that's done legally, this is binded usually legally between governments and things like that. So they have no right to go bomb, and attack places like this. And this type of anarchy system that the U.S. does, and their Israeli, allies and their puppets, should be dealt with strongly in the upcoming days, hopefully, so nothing like this ever happens again.
Thank you very much, Firas Al-Najim, human rights activist, joining us live from Ottawa. Moving on, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton has talked about recent riots in Iran, saying, quote, protesters were armed with weapons smuggled from the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Bolton made the remarks in an interview with a BBC Persian TV channel. He characterized the rioters as opposition and said that he had seen images of some protesters being trained and armed in Iraq's Kurdistan region. Earlier, Iran's Border Guard Command announced the seizure of over 5,000 pieces of U.S.-made cold weapons at borders. The commander of the Border Force, General Ahmad Ali Gudarzi, said over 600 firearms, including pistols, rifles, were also discovered and seized over the past 45 days. Protests erupted in several Iranian cities in September after a young woman fainted at a police station and was pronounced dead in hospital days later. The protests were initially peaceful, but soon turned into riots and vandalism. Sayed Mohammad Marandi is a professor at Tehran University. He says terrorist groups themselves admit to have an active role in recent riots in Iran.
They admit openly, or they claim, that they are active inside Iran. And they claim to be leading the riots. So there's no surprise when people are seen. Photos are taken, footage is taken of people using knives, slitting police officers, Western media as freedom fighters, and Persian language media based in London calling their acts of murder, of burning people alive, of brutality against the police as legitimate. And if these media outlets were in English, Ofcom would, and they were directed towards an English audience or an English country or British English-speaking country, Ofcom would shut these television stations down immediately and put these people on trial.
Israeli forces carry out a new attack in the occupied West Bank, killing one more Palestinian man in the city of Nablus. Israeli forces shot dead 18-year-old Mohammed Hasha during the early hours for Monday. Other Palestinians were seriously injured and taken to hospital. Israel has recently tightened its deadly grip on the occupied West Bank and widened its crackdown on Palestinians there. More than 140 people have lost their lives in the West Bank this year alone. Palestinians have repeatedly called on the international community to help end the Israeli blitz in the occupied territories. North Korea has once again test-fired a ballistic missile amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's military says the North fired the missiles off its east coast. Japan's Coast Guard has also confirmed the launch. Over the past several days, North Korea has fired a barrage of missiles in response to the largest ever war games by Washington and Seoul. Pyongyang considers the military exercises as a rehearsal for an invasion. Washington and Seoul, however, say they are holding the drills because the North is about to resume testing nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017. We're joined by Frank Smith, our correspondent from Seoul. Frank, it seems like an interesting predicament right now. On the one hand, you have North Korea, which says that it is firing these missiles because it is worried about the drills that have been ongoing. It sees this as a rehearsal for an invasion. On the other hand, you have South Korea and the U.S. who are also accusing the North of being a threat to regional peace and therefore continuing their drills. Is there any way out of this stalemate?
Well, I think really the only way out was looked at a few years ago with the engagement policy of Moon Jae-in, the previous president of South Korea. He arranged the summits between himself and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He also arranged the summits between North Korean leader Kim and former U.S. President Donald Trump, which resulted in a calming of tensions on the Korean Peninsula and no long-range ballistic missile tests or nuclear tests for a number of years. Now you have a new president here in South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, and he's vowed to take a hard line with North Korea over its missile testing, which it really sort of ramped up this year with something like 30-odd tests just in the past week, last week, and then from the beginning of the year, 50 tests. Yoon Suk-yeol just came to power here in the South in May, and so I think this is partly a message to the Yoon Suk-yeol administration from North Korea that it's going to continue with its missile and nuclear development, and also a message to the United States. It's kind of doing like strategic patience 2.0. That was the Obama policy of really kind of ignoring North Korea. What we saw during that period was a lot of missile testing and some nuclear testing and seeing North Korea really develop its capabilities here. At the same time, here in South Korea, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance, President Yoon Suk-yeol has wanted to strengthen that alliance, and that's what you see with these recent drills, drills that began in late August that were land-based drills for the first time in 5 years, the largest in 5 years, and then with the recent Air Force drills, the so-called Vigilant Storm drills that took place and ended Saturday. So there might be a response there. Also, there's satellite imagery analysis that indicated North Korea was ready to conduct a nuclear test. These are photos of North Korea's Punggye-ri test site showing that it had reconstructed that site and that it was ready, had laid cables and reconstructed tunnels, and it was ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. That came out earlier in the year, and then intelligence saying it was going to take place between Xi Jinping's sort of coronation that took place about a week ago or a couple of weeks ago and the U.S. midterms. So now the question is North Korea going to conduct their seventh nuclear test anytime soon? And certainly from this missile launch today, it doesn't seem like they're going to calm down at all, especially given, you know, the U.S.-South Korean alliance deciding to, again, continue with its and ramp up its joint military exercises here.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent Frank Smith, live from Seoul. Moving on, in Britain, strikes are planned to be held later in November amid an unprecedented rise in inflation and a nationwide economic crisis. A strike by London Underground workers is set to go ahead on Thursday. Millions of passengers will face disruption in transportation. That after authorities failed to resolve a contract dispute with workers. Officials have cautioned passengers that limited or no service will be expected on Thursday. The workers are demanding pay rise to help soften the blow of inflation that has already gone up to double-digit levels. Meanwhile, more than 70,000 university staff at 150 universities across the country will strike for 3 days over pay, working conditions, and pensions. Their strikes is set to take place on the 24th and 25th and the 30th of November. Eurozone finance ministers meet in Brussels to exchange views on the EU's worsening energy crisis. Governments in the bloc have so far failed to mitigate the economic costs associated with cutting off Russia's cheap gas supplies. Jerome Hughes reports.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country Eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the Eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the Eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the Eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes at the Council of the EU, Brussels.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the United States, Republicans and Democrats are making their last arguments with the midterm elections about to start. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. U.S. political leaders from both sides of the aisle on Sunday, 6th of November, made their closing arguments to voters just 2 days before the hotly contested midterm elections, with several top Democrats framing the election as a referendum on American democracy. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of reveling in political violence, saying hundreds of the party's candidates for state, federal, and local office were election deniers, who say that I did not win the election, even though hundreds of attempts to challenge this in a court of law have failed, even in Republican courts of law. Joe Biden said that for them, there are only two outcomes for any election. Either they win or they were cheated. He said Republicans were willing to condone the 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, and that after a recent attack on Paul Pelosi, husband of the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, some in the party made light of it or were making excuses. There's never been a time in my career when we've glorified violence based on a political preference, Joe Biden said. President Biden made the comment as he wrapped up a five-state, four-day campaign tour with a Sunday evening rally at a college in Yonkers, New York, where he championed the Democratic governor, Kathy Hochul. Kathy Hochul is locked in a tight race with Lee Zeldin, who is looking to become the state's first GOP governor since 2006. Republicans, meanwhile, swung back by saying that they would better address Americans' economic woes and repeatedly insisted their rivals were ill-equipped to help voters despite Democratic rhetoric that the Republicans were to blame for the nation's political divisiveness. Donald Trump stayed evasive on a 2024 presidential run, saying, "I will probably have to do it again, but stay tuned." Teasing an event he has with Republican Senate candidate in Ohio, J.D. Vance, for Monday. Donald Trump added, "We have a big, big rally. Stay tuned for tomorrow night." Trump appeared in Miami, Florida, late on Sunday in support of Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who is seeking another term in office on Tuesday. The former president mocked leftist politicians, promoted his Truth Social platform, and predicted a Republican-controlled Congress would target a number of culture war issues dear to Florida, including critical race theory. "The stakes are about economics," Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar said on CNN's State of the Union program. Klobuchar added, "Every country in the world has been through a hard time coming out of this pandemic. The question that voters have to ask, who do you trust to have people on staff who see them? Who is going to stand up for them? Social Security and Medicare." Amy Klobuchar also warned that a shift right could spell danger for America. She noted that numerous Republican candidates have sowed doubt over the 2020 presidential election and said that Donald Trump's shadow is looming over key states. Klobuchar added, "These candidates are throwing truth out of the window. They're shattering the rule of law and they're laughing at political violence. If you're a Democrat, if you're an independent or moderate Republican, democracy is on the ballot, and it is time to vote for democracy." New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker voiced similar sentiments. "There's a lot on the line, and we have to remember, after what we saw on 6th of January 2021, Republican or Democrat, we should be electing people that believe in our democracy, that believe in our traditions, and that ultimately want to unite people and not to divide them." New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker was speaking on ABC's This Week program. Agence France-Presse has covered the same story. President Joe Biden pulled out the stops on Sunday to mobilize U.S. voters in defense of democracy, hoping to counter a Republican red wave in this week's midterm elections that could help set Donald Trump on a course back to the White House. "If you all show up and vote, democracy sustained, not a joke," the 79-year-old Joe Biden told a rally in upstate New York, historically Democratic territory, with just 2 days to go until next Tuesday's vote. "This is your generation's moment to defend it, to preserve it, to choose it," Biden told the audience at St. Lawrence University, turning solemn as he recalled last year's assault on the U.S. Capitol by Donald Trump's supporters, who refuse to accept defeat. At the southern end of the Atlantic coast in Miami, Florida, Donald Trump held a competing rally in support of Florida Republican candidates, but his own political future was more front and center. Trump said, "I will probably have to do it again." Carrying signs saying, "Again," the crowd yelled back, "Four more years, the length of a U.S. presidential term." Opinion polls in the final stretch put Republicans ahead in the fight for the House of Representatives and also showed them gaining momentum in key Senate races as voters seek to take out frustration over four decades high inflation and rising illegal immigration. Tens of millions of American voters have already cast early ballots, but bringing out the vote on Tuesday will likely prove decisive. With all 435 seats in the House of Representatives up for grabs alongside a third of the 100-member Senate and a slew of state posts, Democrats were putting a brave face on their prospects, but the latest opinion polls have put them on the defensive. "This is going to be a wake-up call to President Joe Biden," predicted Glenn Youngkin, the Republican governor of Virginia, saying his camp was offering common-sense solutions to everyday issues like inflation and crime. U.S. midterm elections are typically seen as a referendum on the president in power, whose party tends to lose seats in Congress, particularly if, as with Joe Biden, the president's approval rating is under 50%. Worryingly for Democrats, a new NBC News opinion poll found that fully 72% of voters believe the country is headed in the wrong direction, 21% who saw it as being on the right track. In swing state of Pennsylvania, Republican Senate candidate Mehmet Oz on Sunday hammered on that message to rile up a crowd at his rally. Mehmet Oz said, "How many of you are worried about America right now?" He asked the crowd in a Pittsburgh suburb, receiving a round of applause.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. midterm elections is upon the U.S., and the Republicans are almost certain that they will take back control of Congress. Meanwhile, this has been called one of the most important elections because the U.S. has never been so polarized. How severe is this polarity, and will it impact these elections? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why many Americans may not even accept the election results, an approach used by the former U.S. President Donald Trump, which has given rise to what's called political violence.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Richard Becker joins us. He's an anti-war activist at the Answer Coalition who joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, James Jatras, former U.S. diplomat who joins us from Belgrade. Welcome to you both. James Jatras, first over to you. So we have the midterm elections. What do you think? They say it's going to be all about the economy, since Americans are dealing with inflation and high living costs. How much do you think the vote is going to be about that or about the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think those two things go together. The fact that we have a totally incompetent president that's visible for the entire world to see, plus a very bad economic situation and inflation by all accounts, should mean a fairly decent night for the Republicans. And not only would the Republicans certainly take the House of Representatives, but very likely would take the Senate at all. But I think there are a lot of signals being sent, particularly by the Democrats, that that may not happen. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't sound like a man who expects to do badly in these elections. Rather than making his pitch to the American people, rather a few days ago, he went out and essentially threatened them and saying that if people don't accept the results of these elections, they're basically fascists, or one of his officials was speaking to Congress and saying essentially they would be agents of the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians if they don't accept the elections because they're fascists. It's very, very strange that somebody who by all rights should be expecting to do badly in an election is in a position of threatening his political opponents as, in essence, foreign agents and traitors if they question the election results. And I think we're already seeing some indications, for example, in the Senate race in Pennsylvania, which again, by all rights, the Republican Mehmet Oz should win, that Mr. Fetterman, his opponent, the lieutenant governor, who's you know, again, it makes even Joe Biden look like a competent person, is saying that he expects the Republicans to have a really good turnout today, but over the next days or even weeks, that he expects to come out on top. So I think there's a lot of very interesting and concerning signals that are being sent.
What do you think about what our guest there from Belgrade, James Jatras, is saying there, Richard Becker, in terms of how Joe Biden has said what he said? I'm sure you heard him. What do you think that means?
Well, I don't really agree with that. I mean, I'm not a supporter of Joe Biden, but I don't think Biden was threatening to manipulate the election results. I think that has been the Republican strategy over a long period of time, is to put people into place, such as secretaries of state, which there's a secretary of state in each state of the United States, and they are responsible in most cases for running elections. The Republican strategy has been to get people into those positions who have taken the position that the 2000 election was illegal, that it was not, the outcome was manipulated, and so forth. So, I mean, the problem with Biden and the Democrats is that they have they've squandered their opportunity to a very large degree. They have, since the Democrats took control of the House and Senate as well as the White House in the 2000 election or following the 2000 election, they have failed to do what they said that they were going to do. They failed to carry out a program that could have really won them the support.
Why do you think that happened?
An unbeatable majority. And they, because instead of being able to carry through that agenda, they focused on things like Russia Gate, so-called, I mean, these kind of ridiculous things, and that they have, as a party, are so divided among themselves that they've been unable to pass the program that had been proposed to relieve the suffering and meet the needs of the people.
Well, when you say a party that's divided, and you talk about how they've had their chance, and that now there's a missed opportunity because, as you mentioned, the focus on Russia. First of all, what issues are they divided on that stands out so glaringly? So, as you, for you to say that, I mean, in that respect, then this party, even if they retain the House or Congress, they're not going to be able to move forward that well if what you're saying is true.
Well, you know, what they're not divided on is war. The so-called Progressive Caucus in Congress, in a very mild statement a few weeks ago, where they first of all said that that they were they praised Biden and the White House and the Pentagon for pouring weaponry into the to Ukraine to carry out what is really a U.S. NATO proxy war against Russia. And they said, well, maybe we should have negotiations too. And they were attacked by their leaders of their own party. And these are all Democrats. They were attacked by the leaders of their own party for even suggesting that there should be negotiations instead of all-out military campaign until victory.
Sure.
At the cost of every, unlimited numbers of Ukrainian and Russian lives.
Sure. Well, this notion of democracy is something that the U.S. President Joe Biden said on the eve of the U.S. midterms. And the statement that he made is, we know in our bones that our democracy is at risk. And we know that this is your moment to defend it. So let me, James Dutras is back. James Dutras, Joe Biden's statements about democracy, how it's, we know in our bones that that it's at risk. And it kind of goes along with what you said, James Dutras. But you would think that the stance that you made, if I'm interpreting it correctly, is something that the Republicans would kind of say, alluding to voter fraud, I'm guessing, based on some of the statements. How do you see the statement by Joe Biden vis-a-vis, of course, the Republican stance altogether?
Well, I took it as a threat. You see, here's what the paradox is that Biden is calling his enemies extremists in every respect. And the fact of the matter is, even if most Republicans think this, wrongly or rightly, even if most Republicans think there was corruption in this election and the election was stolen, just as many of them think that the 2020 election was stolen, Republicans are not going to go out on the street and burn things down the way Democratic supporters burned the country down in 2020 during the BLM riots. So there's this interesting paradox where one side engages in violence and has no consequences for it. The other side doesn't engage in violence, but is treated as enemies of the people. We've seen, for example, the politicization of the FBI and of the justice system to basically take care, to treat opponents of the Biden regime as enemies. And I think, as you started the program, this is an indication of just how polarized this country has become. But the fact of the matter is, one side is using violence and using the politicization of the law enforcement structures of the federal government against its political opponents. The other side,
Which side?
To have no way to really deal with that.
Which side is doing that, James Dutras?
I think the left is doing that. The Biden regime and its supporters are doing that against their opponents.
Richard Brecker, I see you shaking your head. It's interesting that James Dutras says the Biden regime, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there were, after the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, there were demonstrations in more than 5,000 cities and towns in the United States. Less than 0.01% of those had any kind of violence, and there was no violence that ended up with people dead except at the hands of the police. And so now, on January 6th, that was not the left that stormed the Congress. That was the right wing, and led by fascist forces like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. They played a key role in that. I mean, this is your other guest is presenting a new falsification of history. And the reality of it is that the violence that's being threatened now is violence that's coming from the right. And it's people out like today in Arizona with automatic weapons at polling places intended to intimidate people and prevent them from voting. That's happening in many places across the country. That's what's the real threat of violence is coming from the fascists.
James Ross, go ahead.
Well, this is a perfect example of what you're talking about at the beginning of this program. Americans simply do not live in the same country anymore. We have a very polarized society where we are effectively morally aliens to one another, if not enemies. And there's nothing that's going to change that through an electoral process. And the fact of the matter is, I have to dispute what my opponent says, that the 2020, during those mostly peaceful riots that burnt out the middle of many American cities, about 60 people died, and they were not killed by the police, who basically allowed them to do whatever they wanted to do in Democratic-controlled cities. Only one person died on January 6th, and that was an unarmed woman shot by a policeman.
Richard Becker.
You know, that's, again, here you have a mass movement, the largest mass movement in U.S. history. 34 to 35 million people participated in those protests, and they were not riots. They were protests against police brutality.
They were riots, and by
that's
the way, the police did not kill George Floyd.
And you can't change
that.
He was
a criminal who died of a fentanyl overdose. Everybody knows this.
Richard Becker.
Oh. Really, it wasn't the knee on the throat.
No, because he was saying I can't breathe while he was still standing up and not getting in the police car. He's saying I can't breathe while he was standing there. Somebody who can't breathe is not saying I can't breathe.
Okay, so we're saying right now the breakdown amongst you two to be representative. I'm guessing a mirror image of what many Americans think about each other. And it's interesting that you say it's not that James Atrasi said that you were living amongst the aliens in the States, as you mentioned, but you're living in another planet. How did it get to the point where the polarization is not so much an exchange of thoughts as what many polls are indicating that this has to involve some kind of violence? And the reference is being made to the most recent incident that happened with Nancy Pelosi's husband. I mean, where does that line get crossed where violence comes into the picture in the States in this case?
Well, I think let's take this Pelosi thing for an example. All the indications we've seen is that this unhinged gentleman who was caught in this very odd situation with Mr. Pelosi was some kind of a LGBT nudist activist of some sort, very much on the left wing if he had any politics at all. He seems to be a rather flaky individual. What kind of relationship, if any, he had with Mr. Pelosi, I don't know. Yet this is somehow being turned into by the mainstream media, which is essentially regime media that's in the pocket of the big corporations that, oddly enough, left-wing people in this country now support because it supports all their rainbow, homosexual, transgender agenda, which they want to impose on this country and, let's be honest, on the rest of the world. That somehow we've got woke capitalism in a kind of a fascist relationship with a left-wing regime that wants to suppress the American people who are mostly passive, are not doing anything, are not threatening okay. violence, but are being accused of being violent extremists.
You know, there's some points
That's
of views there.
In this position.
Thank you, James Atrasi. Richard Becker, some points of views there that James Atrasi has relayed, from LGBTQs to, if I said that correctly in that order, to the other opinions that he just said. And again, these are things that he said that the left-wing regime, I guess, is what you said, is being exercised on the Americans. Do you feel that way? Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. And the person who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband was a left-wing conspiracy theorist of who they are, who evolved into a right-wing, an extreme right-wing a conspiracy theorist. And that's why he carried out the attack that he did. And that's why he carried out what he was hoping would be an attack on Nancy Pelosi. And again, I'm not a supporter of Nancy Pelosi or the Democratic Party, but I think that there's no question that that's what happened. And this idea
right.
that there's a homosexual agenda is complete. That's a theory that has no
Richard
basis
Becker, quick question. Why isn't anybody for Nancy Pelosi? It seems like that's something that's been going on for quite some time.
Well, she has her supporters. As I said, I'm not a Democrat, but there are, you know, there's a very large Democratic Party that does support Nancy Pelosi. And the person who attacked her and who sought to attack her and did attack her husband
right.
Was not from the left. He was a person who had been persuaded by these conspiracy theories that somehow there was this agenda that was going on and it was meant to turn everyone into pedophiles or something. I mean, it's complete garbage. It's just ridiculous garbage, but mm-hmm. that's what's being passed around as a real political outlook.
James Atrasi, go ahead if you have a reaction.
Yeah, it's a conspiracy. Huh? Just Google drag queen story hour. Just Google family-friendly drag queen shows and seeing what's being normalized in American schools, telling kids that they should dress up or be or trans transition, as they say, into another sex. This is being supported by the Biden regime. I do call it a regime, by the corporations. And this is America's agenda abroad. This is what we're trying
percentage?
To force on countries. We talk about countries like Ukraine, for example, talking about countries in Eastern Europe, in Serbia, where I am at the moment. This is the kind of agenda that this sick regime is trying to push on the American people and on the rest of the world. And a lot of ordinary Americans don't like it. My only complaint is we don't know what to do about it because we're talking about honest, law-abiding people, family people, married people with kids, church-going people who don't like these kind of values.
James Atras, when you say that, what percentage, if you were to take a guess, unless you know a solid fact from a source, does America fall into the lines that you just said that are for or against what you said?
Well, see, that's the trouble. I think we don't really know. I think, unfortunately, it basically breaks down to about half and half with more extreme elements on either side. I would say more people on the right side are basically just sort of normal people who just want to live their lives and not accept this agenda. Is that a majority of the population? Probably not anymore. Maybe 35, maybe 40% of the population, but maybe another 10 or 20% will vote along with them. Same thing on the other side. I'm sure you have some very radical fringe on the left that espouses all of these values, but another 30, 40% of the population will vote along with them because they think they're voting for compassion or tolerance or any of these things. But the bottom line to me is that which side is the big money and the political power on? It's on the side of the left.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things there, Richard Becker, obviously, that James Atras said, I'm sure would not fly in San Francisco. But since we just have a few minutes left over here, let's move on to the foreign policy arena and see what's going to happen there. I mean, if all indications come out to be true in terms of the Republicans taking control of the Senate or the House or both, what are we looking at when it comes to, for example, hot button issues like Iran?
Well, unfortunately, there is a bipartisan foreign policy of the United States, and it's an imperialist foreign policy. And so we have Trump having, in regard to Iran, having shut down, walked out of the JCPOA unilaterally, really a violation of that treaty. We have Trump having increased the imposition of sanctions, 243 new sanctions on Cuba, causing great suffering to the people. It's increasing the sanctions on Iran, doing the same thing. But then you have Biden, who when he was running, said he was going to change those policies, and he has not. So there's no new JCPOA. There's still sanctions on Iran. There's a maintenance of the sanctions blockade against Cuba. And there is a foreign policy that is getting bipartisan support for the U.S.-NATO proxy war against Russia, a war that really threatens the whole world with nuclear destruction, and a war that needs to come to an end, and can only come to an end not based on a decision by Zelensky, who I think is the president of Ukraine, who I think is just a puppet, but it's the refusal of the U.S. and NATO to negotiate, going all the way back to last year when there was an opportunity for that, and instead has fueled this war. And that's a Republican and Democratic joint project.
Keep hearing about Republicans, James Atras, that are going to tone down the aid, military aid or assistance overall, perhaps, to Ukraine. Are we really looking at that happening? Were they to take control?
No, I don't think so. And this is where I do agree with my colleague on the program, is that we do have two warmongering parties. And even though I think there will be more Trump-type mega populists who are being demonized by the other side, they're really the only ones that might be somewhat opposed to some of this stuff. But even they will be a tiny minority. In the Republican office holders, the leadership will be even more warmongering than the Democrats are. And, of course, the left wing of the Democratic Party that used to be a peace wing of the Democratic Party has totally collapsed. We had that fiasco a few weeks ago where a number of left-wing members, you know, the progressive bloc in the House, had written mildly urging negotiations and were forced to retract it because their betters in the party, I guess, to hold them down. So it's really sad. We have some populist right opposition to these things, but it's very small, and it's not really going to have much of an impact. My only fear is that the Republicans take the Congress, and that they'll simply demand even more money for Ukraine, more militancy in global affairs. So unfortunately, I think my colleagues, he and I agree on this.
Okay. Final question. I see we have some time here. I'm going to go back to what you had a UN special rapporteur say back in the year 2020, where he decried near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights. Richard Becker, electoral laws in some part of the U.S., like Texas, may undermine democracy by depriving millions of citizens the equal right to vote. Are we going to look at that happen perhaps this time, or is this a norm, or what do you think about this? Again, this was something that came out based on a report back in 2020.
It's very widespread, and it's aimed at particularly at Black voters, also Latino voters, to restrict their access to voting. After years of trying to of expanding the access, now there have been in many states restrictions that have been put into place. And I think this is because the right wing can't really win the elections anymore if everyone gets to vote. You know who said that? Donald Trump. He said that a few years ago. He said, if we let everybody vote, the Republicans will never win another election. So the strategy is, let's shut down voting rights. Let's make voting more difficult. Why does voting even take place in the United States on a Tuesday, today? Why not and why isn't it a national holiday? So, because it makes it so much more difficult.
Let me give 30 seconds to James Jatras. James Jatras, in closing, anything you'd like to say?
I would agree with my colleague on moving elections from Tuesday to a Saturday or a Sunday. If he will agree with me that people to register to vote must not only provide proof of their identity, but proof of their citizenship, which simply does not happen. What he talks about, what ballot security measures are designed to make sure that people who are voting are actually citizens of the United States and actually who they are, who they say they are. Instead, what we get is the massive dumping of mail-in ballots,
right,
which is an open recipe for fraud.
Thank you, James Jatras, former U.S. diplomat from Belgrade. Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist, Answer Coalition, San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
from our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam economized when it came to spending upon himself. He lived a rather ascetic, simple lifestyle. But His Eminence Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spent a great abundant amount of wealth on the poor and the needy people amongst the Muslims. And it is precisely because of this unequaled and unparalleled generosity that Imam al-Jawad has been called and titled Al-Jawad, the Generous. This surname was the most particular and famous surname of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, to the extent that he was well known and famous for it amongst the people.
Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam stated, "He who conceals the path of proper conduct from you in making you follow that which you desire is indeed your enemy."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the wonderful and beautiful dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. One of the things that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spoke about in length was the concept and the ideas and the questions and the various aspects surrounding the 12th divinely appointed Imam, the Qa'im from the family of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon them all. Now, in one such conversation, we find that one of the close companions of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, is a conversation that he has again with one of his close companions by the name of Abdul Azim al-Hasani. Now, Abdul Azim al-Hasani in the traditions and in the historical texts is considered to be a very revered individual, a very esteemed personality,